Hello, welcome along. If you're looking for a place where you get debate, reasoned intellectual argument, and a thinking person's guide to Christianity and atheism and all other kinds of worldviews, you've come to the right place. Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley, between now and 4 o'clock, here on Premier Christian Radio, part of our wider programming every Saturday afternoon, Faith Explored, where you can hear all kinds of issues debated and talked about from people who are leaders in their field. And don't forget, later on this afternoon, we've got our profile interview, and we're going to be hearing Lord Paul Boateng, who delivered our premier lecture in the last week or so, and that will be able to be listened back to as well tomorrow evening on Premier Christian Radio at 9 o'clock. But right now, it's Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half, as we bring another Christian and non-Christian together on today's show for dialogue and debate. If you want to find out more about the show and how to look for past programmes, extra features and all that kind of thing, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Links there, of course, as well to Unbelievable, the conference 2014, less than a month away now. Just 4 weeks to go. Saturday, the 12th of July, is the date that you should have clearly marked in your diary. And if you haven't booked in yet, do go to the website and find out how to do that and look at all the stuff that's on offer as well. premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith, and you'll be able to find out the vast array of seminars that are going on throughout the day on various issues around the Christian faith and how to answer tough questions about it. About the contributors, William Lane Craig, Oz Guinness, Craig Hazen, Tanya Walker, Jeff Swearink, he was on our show last week, Clay Jones, he's going to be on a show shortly too, Ruth Jackson and David Robertson, and of course Tim McGrew. And you can find out all the details there. It's really going to be a fantastic day. And if you haven't booked in, why not check out the group options on bookings. Book two or more tickets, you'll get a free DVD courtesy of Biola, who we're partnering with this year on the conference. It's also in association with Reasons to Believe. So really looking forward to that. premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith for more on Unbelievable, the conference 2014, Central London, July the 12th. Well, let's get into today's programme. Two special guests join me to discuss a new book that's recently hit the shelves. You're unbelievable. So my guest today in studio is Krish Kandiah, speaker and lecturer and Executive Director for Churches in Mission at the Evangelical Alliance. And his latest book, Paradoxology, examines some of the paradoxes, apparent paradoxes, at the heart of the Christian faith and how engaging them can actually strengthen rather than weaken our search for truth. The subtitle of the book is Why Christianity Was Never Meant to Be Simple. And anyone who's listened to this show for any length of time can certainly agree with that, in a sense that there's lots of things to discuss, debate, and that's what we enjoy doing on this programme. So, Krish, thank you very much for coming on the programme today.
Pleasure to be here, Justin. Thank you.
I'm not sure we've had you on Unbelievable before. You've been on Premier Christian Radio many a time, but not on this show.
No, I love the show. Lots of my friends listen to it. In fact, I have a friend in America that I know is listening to this right now, him and his son.
There you go. Okay, well, hello, friend in America, and thank you for listening. Yes, we do have an international audience across the UK, across the world, via the podcast. But yourself, I mean, do you want to just give us a little intro to your own story? Because you kind of bring that out a little bit, at least, in the course of the book you've written here. What brought you to faith initially?
So I come from a kind of mixed faith and mixed race background. My mother was born in India, but her father was Irish, and so she had a kind of Catholic upbringing. My father was born in Malaysia, but his father was Sri Lankan, Sri Lankan Tamil, so he had a Hindu upbringing. And so as a child, they didn't induct me into either faith. They kind of let me choose for myself. And weirdly, it was partly through a Salvation Army band when I was kind of 7 or 8 years old. I thought, that looks kind of interesting. Let's go there. And so I went to kind of Sunday school, and I was the brownest kid there by a long way. And I was the little boy with all the questions, because everyone else kind of assumed it to be true. But I didn't know any of the stories, and I was trying to piece it together. And I did have a lovely, very patient Sunday school teacher, but her answer often to difficult questions was, well, you know, God works in mysterious ways, or if we could know that, then we'd be God. Or what was the last one? Oh, yeah, get on with your colouring, you know. So, and that's all right, you know, that kind of gets you by. But it wasn't until I was about 15 and a friend of mine just had an experience of God. He went to a kind of Christian rally run by a guy called John Wimber, and just had a life-changing experience. And he came in the next day into school and he said, I've become a friend of God. If anyone wants to know anything about it, come and see me.
Resident expert.
I know. He was a day old as a Christian. And he just began to share his faith. And I told no one I went to church or anything. And we just began to try to help our mates kind of think about it and uncover it. And our friends had a gabillion questions. You know, how do you know the devil didn't write the Bible? What about science? And, you know, is Jesus really the only way to God? And we just didn't have any answers. And we went back to the Bible. We phoned friends, read books. And some of the people that you've had on your show were people I was kind of reading to try and understand. And just by trying to face up to the tough questions, we found our faith actually grew. That Christianity wasn't something you need to hide from difficult questions. Your faith, if it's not true, it's not worth believing.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So that really made an impact.
And you've been helping, in a sense, in your role with the EA and in other ways, students, Christians across the country, churches engage with, you know, opening up and having answers and having a dialogue and that kind of thing. That for you is quite an important part of how we do mission today.
Yeah,
in the
yeah.
UK.
I mean, I was involved in university work for a long time. I still am. You know, I'm going to speak at a university CU on Friday. But I love to do it as a dialogue, you know, that I don't claim exhaustive knowledge about God. Mm. You know, only God has exhaustive knowledge about God. And I come from a cultural context. So there are things I don't understand, I might have missed. And in conversation, you can learn more. It doesn't mean I'm a relativist. So I studied a guy called Leslie Newbegin, and he talked about the way that science works is that a scientist believes something to be true, not just for them, but true for everybody. He holds it with universal intent, as it were.
Yeah.
And then other people then, through their critique and engagement, are actually able to refine that belief and get it clearer. So I find when I do a lunchtime talk, I'll, you know, speak for 15 minutes and then take questions. Those questions are not just me trying to trap someone into thinking the way I think.
Sure.
I want it to be a genuine
It is an engagement. Open-ended yeah. kind of approach yeah. that you're wanting to take. Well, we're going to talk about the book in a moment's time, which is really interesting. There's been a great article as well accompanying in Premier Christianity magazine. I'll make sure we link to that as well from today's podcast and so on. But our other guest on today's programme is Tony Smollett. Tony, am I pronouncing your name correctly, first
That's
of all?
That's right, yeah, Smollett.
Great. You're an IT director. You've described yourself as a big rugby fan, a passionate supporter of equality, LGBT rights, and republicanism. So you've obviously someone who knows what you think about things, but you're an atheist, and I know you've listened at least to on occasion to this program as well. Just give us a little bit of your background, Tony. Did you have any kind of dalliance with Christianity in terms of family and so on growing up?
Yeah, I did, Justin, and I think the description's very, very true. I almost came to atheism through that route that you described, through thinking carefully about equality and about women's equality, about LGBT rights, and I'm also a Republican with a small R, not an American Republicanism. So it's a very UK focused Republicanism.
Yes, for our American audience, probably important to point that out.
Yeah, just in case people are confused, and I suppose if I believed in God, I'd have a real problem with organized religion anyway.
Right.
So, you know, that's a sort of, that's a context I think is helpful for me. But yes, as a child, when I was very young, under 10, my dad was still alive. We attended the Church of Scotland, which was a very traditional Presbyterian type upbringing. And in my teens, I went to a church in Aberdeen, which was preached at by the Reverend William Still, who's quite a famous evangelical.
Mm.
And attracted a lot of students to that ministry. I was in the Scripture Union, and so I had, and we did, you know, the tours of churches, as you sometimes do. So I saw, you know, Baptist, Apostolic, and various other sorts of churches. So yes, I've spent quite a lot of time with Christian people, Christian friends, and obviously within the family, my father-in-law is a lay preacher in the URC. So quite a lot of background.
Yes, indeed. But something that you never ultimately came to embrace yourself at any point along that journey?
No, that's right. And I've been listening to a lot of the back catalogue on Unbelievable. I started listening to it when I listened to the Richard Dawkins Rowan Williams debate.
Yes.
Which was a great debate, really interesting. And I've listened to the whole, you know, elements of the whole back catalogue, from the bombastic to the very balanced debates. And I've been really impressed with the level of debate, but I am stuck on a real view that I don't believe there is a God. I believe many things have been invented by men, and I've got anxiety about the sort of control that some religions exert on people.
Yeah, and I know that's a particular concern of yours, but primarily is as you say, organized religion, certain forms of Christianity, which you feel go against this passion you have for equality and so on. We might come to some of that, I guess, in the course of talking things through. Mm-hmm. We'll come to you again in a moment's time, yeah. Tony, for your thoughts on the book, which you've had a good old read of. Thank yeah. you for doing that in a relatively short space of time that I gave you to do that. But thank you for joining us on the programme today. Sounds like we're going to have a really interesting interaction with you, Tony. So coming back to you, Krish, paradoxology. That's a word you've kind of made up, isn't it, basically?
Yes, I made that up. I thought it worked nicely. Obviously, the word paradox, two seemingly contradictory statements or logical conclusions, and the Bible does seem to have a lot of things that seem to be contradictory. What do you do with those? Mm. And doxology is to praise or to worship. And so the idea was, well, could those really difficult parts of the Bible be a route to find out more about God? Mm. That was the intention.
You've subtitled it, Why Christianity Was Never Meant to Be Simple. There's a great little video as well, which I'll link to from the podcast today. Lovely little actor. I don't know who it was who you've actually used for the video.
Just a friend of my daughter's who looks a little bit like me. And it's just
when you
very
were
precocious.
That age. Yeah. But raising his hand in Sunday school and so on. I mean, in that sense, would you say that the question should never go away for a Christian in terms of wrestling with scripture and so on?
Yeah, definitely. I remember when I was studying chemistry at university, it was coming to the first year exams, and I saw something on the side of one of my tutor's doors. It was a Winnie the Pooh quote. It says, "There's been an alarming increase in the number of things I know nothing about." And of course, the more you know about something, the more you should become humble, shouldn't you? And realise, I've just got a kind of drop in the ocean compared to the field.
I think that's often why, you know, going back to your friend who had this amazing experience, but there's often a sense in which, in the first sort of flourish, bloom of Christian life, there can almost sometimes be a bit of an arrogance, if you like. I know it all now, and it's only sort of 10 years on you realise, oh, I didn't really know it all, did I?
Yes, exactly right. And we, you know, there's a famous missiologist called David Bosch, and he talks about Christians needing a bold humility. And we seem to be either really arrogant, you know, just telling everybody what to do and think, and that's really unhelpful, or we're so shy and retiring we never try to explain anything to anyone. But I think bold humility is right. You know, that Christians believe this to be true. There is a God. You know, he became human in Jesus. He lived and died, rose again, and in him we find the secrets and the mystery of the universe. But it doesn't mean Christians know everything about everything. We've just been gripped by that truth.
As you say, I mean, at the very core of Christianity is a paradox, the idea of a God who is both, well, someone who is both human and God. And each of your chapters in the book deals with a different paradox based on a character in the Bible. We're going to try and get to a couple of those in the course of today's programme. But the Jesus paradox, I suppose, is a central one, the God who is divinely human. It is two completely different things coming together. Mm. And so in that sense, is faith about somehow living in these kind of apparent contradictions, these paradoxes?
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, going back to my chemistry degree, our first ever lecture, and it was scary. So everyone was wearing their white lab coats and all ready for the lecturer to come in. And we were going to have a lecture in physical chemistry. And our professor, I don't know whether he dressed up for the day or not, but he looked like an archetypal chemistry professor. He had crazy haircut, big glasses, massive lab coat. And he spent the whole, I don't know, first 15 minutes writing this huge equation on the board. And then he basically tried to explain to us how light can be a wave and a particle at the same time. And even though that it seems to hold contradictory properties, so sometimes, light can go through a diffraction grating and be in two places at the same time. But it's also a particle and it can hit things.
Yeah.
And so he said, well, you know, scientists had an option there. They could have just ignored half of the evidence and said, you know, light is a wave, just deal with it. Or they could have said light is a particle. But they said, no, even though we don't have a mental category, we haven't got a model in our brain how these two contradictory things can hold together, we're going to create a new term that helps us hold it in tension. And we call it wave-particle duality. There's no way to picture that. And in the same way, I think Christians, when they read the Bible, and they came across, hold on, Jesus really is claiming to be fully human. You know, he gets thirsty, he's hungry, there's stuff he doesn't know. He has a physical body, he's in one place at one time, and yet he's making the claim that he is divine. We could, you know, as some of the cults do, ignore some of the evidence. He's just a man or he's just God. But they held those two things together and they came up with this concept of the dual nature of Christ.
Yeah.
So I see that as the humility of being able to say, sometimes my brain can't fully conceptualize something, but I'm going to hold these things in tension.
Yeah, well, we're going to get into some of these paradoxes as we go. And as I say, Tony Smollett, our other guest, who's an atheist joining us today, has had a chance to read through. Tony, what was your impression? Do you feel like this book is one that you can get something out of even as a non-Christian, you know, engaging with some of these issues and bits of scripture and some of these apparent contradictions and paradoxes yourself?
Yeah, I certainly enjoyed reviewing the paradoxes and the challenge of making myself think, what if they are true? So what if all the things, so if the Bible's true and all these things are true, then how would I try and work out these paradoxes myself? Although it's really good that it covered the Old and New Testament. There'd be quite an easy cop-out to cover the New Testament onwards. but Christian, you didn't do that, and I think that's really good. That's really helpful to try and give that complete view. And I also really like that you included atheist and other faith views. I think that really adds to the currency of the book, because you're thinking about those other people in contrast to maybe some of the other people you've talked about or we've talked about. So I really enjoyed that. I suppose what I find puzzling and difficult is the, you know, quite intellectual theological arguments to explain some of these paradoxes when there are two simple explanations. One of which is that it's essentially the work of men, and that there isn't a God, and that the sort of lovely complex arguments that Krish comes up with that make sense. You know, they make sense to me in the context of what he's trying to write about. But there's a simpler explanation, which is that the Bible's the work of men. They wrote the Bible for a long time, and they didn't have a very good editor.
and in a sense, Krish is coming along after the fact to sort of do his own theological editing to kind of bring it all together at some level.
Absolutely, and it made a lot more sense than many things I've heard on Unbelievable and read elsewhere. You know, it made a lot more sense than that, and it wasn't bombastic, which I think is a real help when you're trying to have a debate. Mm.
Yeah, what's the purpose then for you of this book, Krish? I mean, do you accept first of all Tony's point that there is another explanation for this, that there simply is a contradiction, and it's born out of the fact that it was written by different people at different times and they've got different views, and you don't have to find a clever way of fitting it all together?
Sure, I understand where Tony's coming from, and thanks for your generous words about the book, Tony. That's really kind of you. I guess, of course, I'm coming from a different mindset that scripture is a historical document that reported events that actually took place. For me, it was coming to know Jesus as who he is, as a person that lived and died and rose again. And that It was knowing Jesus that made me trust the Old Testament, because Jesus did. So that was my kind of way in. Of course, there's another option to think this stuff didn't happen. But I would argue it still leaves you with unresolved paradoxes. And I did try to engage with some of those in the book as well. When we go through, maybe that will come out. But it's not just the Christian faith that faces paradoxes it can't quite fully resolve. And so to kind of dismiss Christianity because the paradoxes are there, I would say actually you've still got to deal with the paradoxes within other world systems, whether that's atheism, Hinduism or Islam.
Well, we're going to get into some of these paradoxes in a moment's time. If you want to find out more about Krish, the book, and indeed Tony, go to the website, of course, of Unbelievable. You can find full details there, the chance to listen back to the programme and share it on, subscribe on iTunes and so on. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And if you'd like to comment on what you're hearing today, why not send me an email? unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And the ways to get in contact via Facebook and Twitter also there as well. At UnbelievableJB if you want to follow me, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page of the show. Talking about paradoxology today here on Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio. I hope you can stay with us right through till 4 o'clock.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Okay, let's open up one or two of these areas. Firstly, I just had to sort of leap in really on a couple of these. Each chapter, Krish, gives a different character in the Bible as a sort of example of a paradox that occurs in Scripture to do with our faith. And we've got one at least from the Old Testament that I wanted to look at, which is the Job paradox, the God who is actively inactive. And in this chapter, you kind of cover the issue of suffering to some extent, which the book of Job has traditionally always sort of, you know, spoken a great deal to. But what did you particularly want to draw out in this, in terms of this age old question of suffering that comes up time and again on this show? What did you want to draw out in terms of a paradox when it comes to this?
Well, I like the way that the Bible faces up to it. You know, it's asking the big philosophical question straight there. It's not assuming it's not going to be an issue for us. And it spends, you know, 40-odd chapters kind of wrestling with it and just showing, you know, where it gets to. I guess, again, the strange thing is the book of Job is about a narrative about someone who's experiencing extreme suffering, never actually finds out why.
We don't get a neat answer.
You don't get a neat answer. And it ends in a point of worship. So, you know, it was a kind of classic kind of paradoxology. You've got God allowing suffering to happen, someone not understanding why it does happen, and yet still being in a place where they could worship God. So I thought that's a really meaty issue to kind of have a look at.
So and what do you mean then when the subtitle of the chapter, the God who is actively inactive? That's the paradox you're drawing out there.
Yeah, so if you know the story of Job, you'd know that you've got this idea that the devil is allowed to impact Job's life in all sorts of terrible ways, and God doesn't stop him. He doesn't withhold that, and so mess happens. And so I guess that's the paradox. You know, we believe in a God who's deliberately not getting involved in that context. Why would he do that? How can a loving God allow bad things to happen to Job?
Yeah. And in the course of that, how do you kind of, do you try to resolve that paradox? Do you say it is mysterious at some level?
Well, I was really helped, obviously. You know, everyone loves C.S. Lewis's Problem of Pain. He does it in Mere Christianity as well, that kind of free will defense. I find that a useful construct. I think you can see that from the rest of the Bible, that God creates a good world. Human beings are allowed to interact with that world, and given some level of autonomy, that autonomy leads to mess and suffering, so that my intentional actions can hurt other people. Is that God's fault? No, because he's allowing us free will to kind of do that. And you know, God, that's not God's intention. One day God's going to fix all that. He allowed his own son to suffer in order that we could have that suffering. He could experience suffering, but he could fix suffering in the end when Jesus comes back again. But weirdly, that, you know, in 40-odd chapters, you don't get that in the book of Job. So I wanted to wrestle with that a bit. You know, why don't you get a nice, neat little answer? And I think for Job, the end of the book is basically he's being told to wait on God, to trust God, to see the bigger picture of what God is doing, and to trust him when he doesn't have an answer. And I think in one sense that is quite a helpful mindset, in that Christians are supposed to use their brains, we're supposed to think it all out, but we're not always going to get any answers to our questions. And how do you live with God when you don't get that answer? That seems to be where Job's going.
Yeah. The issue of suffering for you, Tony, is this one that would count as a significant reason for you to reject Christianity?
Not in itself. Not the concept of suffering. I can understand from the point of view of just my whole agenda of equality and respect for human beings. So I'm not a humanist. I'm not involved in any organization like that. But, you know, we create this artificial construct that is civilization, and it is an artificial construct, I believe, to essentially redistribute wealth and try to treat people more fairly and help the strong as well as the weak, without any necessity for the construct of religion. Within that, I do see suffering as random events. Mm. And unfortunately, it's difficult sometimes to confront the void of, you have a limited time on earth, you're very lucky to have been born from the millions of eggs that exist in every woman. You're very lucky to be born, enjoy the time you've got, and through that show some respect and try to treat people well and equally, and then the difficult things will happen. I find the concept of me still suffering because of Adam and Eve, I find that a difficult one to understand, even if I believed. And of course, the chapter's got introduces another supernatural being alongside God, which is Satan. I find all that quite difficult.
Yeah, I suppose that there is that question of, in a sense, when you're importing a whole load of stuff to this question in the Job story, is that a helpful thing or not for you?
You said earlier, Krish, the Bible's a historical document, and parts of the Bible I'm really happy to believe are clearly a historical document. The figure of Jesus seems to have existed as a person. Many of the characters mentioned clearly did exist, and much of the influence was good, benign, some of it maybe wasn't. But so I'm happy to believe in a historical document, but the supernatural pieces and some of the going back to some of the further reaches of the Old Testament, I can't and don't believe.
I think Job does count as, I think, just about our earliest new Old Testament document in terms of how far back it was sort of set down. We'll come to you in a moment for that, Chris, just a response to that, because I think that opens up other questions as well. But we do just need to go to a quick break already. Yes, time is flying by. We're discussing Paradoxology, new book by Krish Kandar. He's a speaker and lecturer, executive director for Churches in Mission at the Evangelical Alliance, and aims to show why, for Christians, paradoxes are not necessarily a hindrance to faith. They can be a path to truth. Christianity, after all, was never meant to be simple. He's in conversation with our atheist guest today, Tony Smollett. I'm Justin Brierley. We'll be back in a moment's time with more here on Unbelievable.
Was Jesus really raised from the dead? How can we know that God exists? How do we explain evil, pain and suffering in the world? And can faith be reconciled with modern science? Few universities are bold enough to answer yes to all these questions, but California's Biola University is premier amongst them. Biola University offers distance learning graduate degrees in theology, science, and apologetics that answer the toughest questions people ask about your faith. So to get the confidence you need to stand for Christ in a cynical age, visit biola.edu/apologetics. That's biola.edu/apologetics.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to part two of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, your host every week here on the show that aims to get you thinking, whether you're a Christian, an atheist, somewhere in between, or of another worldview altogether. Lovely to have you along this Saturday afternoon, or indeed any time in the week, via our podcast, premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And keep listening later on in the show when we're going to be hearing your feedback. Someone's emailed this week to say they don't think the show treats the atheist guests fairly. And you'll find out why later on in the programme. But we are doing an atheist Christian discussion today, and we'll be back to that in just a moment's time. But if you're interested in engaging with atheism, perhaps as a Christian, or perhaps just interested in some of the big questions around Christianity, such as whether we can have a reasonable faith, Jesus and the gospel, some of the big questions around science and faith, evil and suffering, the Old Testament, and indeed reaching others. Those are the seminar streams that we're running at Unbelievable, the conference 2014 this year. So book yourself in. You can do that by going to the website premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. And we're doing it in association with Biola University this year and in partnership with Reasons to Believe. For Unbelievable, the conference 2014, Saturday the 12th of July, here in central London at Westminster Central Hall. Fantastic venue as well. And you'll be hearing some of a little sort of a video thing we put together a little later on in the show as well. But for the moment, if you want to book yourself in, premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. And it's been great to hear of all the people who have already done that. And I'm looking forward to meeting on the day. Okay, let's get back into today's discussion. We're talking about paradoxology. That's the name of the new book by Krish Kandiah. He's coming to talk to us about it today and to interact with our atheist guest today, Tony Smollett. So coming back to you, Krish, and Tony there was outlining, as an atheist, his understanding of pain, suffering. We live in a random universe. We live in a random world. We're lucky to be here. Mm. Pain comes along. You've got your sort of theology to help you cope with that. But it involves a lot of extra stuff, which I just don't see as necessary in the equation. Supernatural stuff, you know, even, you know, the devil in the Job story and all of that stuff. So why for you is it helpful when it comes to the issue of suffering to be grounded in this story and a faith like the one you have?
So Tony's point that for a lot of atheists, suffering just happens. It's just random. You know, that's spot on. You know, to quote Dawkins, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. And yet, Tony rightly, and I just want to applaud him, you know, wants to see a greater human equality, you know, good equal rights for all sorts of people from all sorts of backgrounds. I think that's a really right instinct. But where does that come from? You know, what is the story that makes best sense of that if in the end there's no difference between good and evil, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference? Where does the moral framework come from that allows us to make those kind of moral judgments? Why shouldn't rich people be rich? Why shouldn't the strong survive and the weak die out? That's what we observe in nature. So we need some other mechanism or some other route to explain why we have that kind of moral sense. And I think the Christian story, you know, from Genesis to Revelation, provides that framework. And it isn't just a parable. This story is actually grounded in the reality of the person of Jesus, that he really took, he really entered our world, told us what it was all about.
But it almost makes it worse in some ways. And I'll let you comment on this if you like as well, Tony, that if you like, it's an issue if you're an atheist. It's sad that there's pain and suffering. But if you're a Christian, it's not just an issue. It's like there's a God who could do something about it. It makes it an unfair issue kind of thing. So at what level does having God in the equation kind of, does it bring any resolution to the issue of suffering, or does it just heighten it?
No, well, I, in the last chapter of the book, I tell a story of where my neighbour and I had, my neighbour had fallen down the stairs and he'd really hurt himself very badly, couldn't move. And we were waiting for an ambulance to come. And if we, you know, I lived in Albania for 3 years. In Albania, an ambulance would never have come. There's no ambulance system. So there would have been no hope that anything would ever resolve on this thing. And so we would have just kind of resigned ourselves that he probably would have been crippled for the rest of his life. So Christianity, by introducing the nature of hope, that there is a God that can resolve suffering, that can do something about it, you're right, it does introduce another problem, as it were. But I don't think many atheists live consistently with the idea that there is, in the end, just blind, pitiless indifference. I think we try to impose some kind of moral framework on the world. You know, Tony, I love your passion for equality. What is it that drives it? Why bother if in the end There is no purpose. There is no life. There's just blind, pitiless indifference. Why bother striving for equality?
I think at a base level, there is that it's just it's easier than the opposite. At a base level, it's easier that I'm not fighting for my food each day with weapons. So there's a basic level of the construct of civilization, the separation of tasks and the separation of responsibilities makes life easier for humans. Thus, we can propagate more freely. Plus, we can grow, and we can it can be a safer environment for everyone. So, I think there's some quite basic levels. I think I think many people who are atheists are also driven by a real agenda for equality, and some work I did around discussing with people in the LGBT movement about same-sex marriage. Many people who are marginalised are radicalised into having a greater equality agenda. So I think within the secular and the atheist community and the agnostic community, there are many people who've got a passion for that, and it's self-driven. It's self-driven by, I've got this limited time. What good can I do as a secular person who doesn't believe in other things in a life after death? How do I make life better for people who are here now?
I suppose this is a theme that you both may realise we come to quite often on the show, but it often ties in, doesn't it, the issue of suffering with the argument from morality and where do we get this moral framework from that Krish has talked about. But in a sense, I suppose I would want to ask then you, Tony, well, you could, I suppose, tell some kind of evolutionary story about why, you know, greater cooperation leads to, you know, an easier life all round and so on, and maybe that's where our moral duties and instincts come from. But it sounds to me like you actually believe in equality as good in itself, not just as good for making it easier for me to live my life. It sounds like you actually believe that equality is somehow almost, dare I use the word, a transcendent factor of our world, that there really is a right and wrong about this. There is a fair and an unfair aspect to this.
Yeah, and that's about the point where I start arguing against myself. So yes, and in that sense, of course, I can't prove the negative, so I can't prove there is no God. Mm. You know, I can't do that. No one can do that. I challenge anyone to do that. So I can't prove there is no God, so I don't know. You know, perhaps I'm being worked through, but my instinct and my feeling is that people do it partly because out of self-interest, and partly because they've been brought up in a moral code that leads them to believe that will be a good thing to do. I mean, I look at my in-laws, my parents-in-law, who are in the URC, and I've been to some of their services, and it's such a lovely community of people that if I was just meeting them in a town hall, it would be equally as good and equally as enjoyable. But they do it through their faith. That's great. You know, it's completely benign, completely giving, completely loving. In a true secular society, everybody would have absolute freedom to do that, and that's for me, again, that's very important. Religious freedom as part of the equality agenda is very, very important. People must be able to believe exactly what they want.
Again, Tony, I love it. I love this passion for equality, and I think it's a right and good thing. I just think the narrative in which that makes best sense is one where there is a God that says, actually, you are all equal, that every human being, every life is valuable, and that is a transcendent value that I don't think you can find if God isn't in the equation. Because in actual fact, you know, practically, we're not all equal. There are very rich people, there are very poor people. Poor people don't live as long as rich people. You know, if you're a vulnerable child in our society, your chances of getting good education and good life outcomes are not good unless someone kind of gets in there and fosters or adopts you. So we move from this is, which is there is inequality, to the ought, that things ought to be different. And that makes sense if there's a moral framework.
There's this kind of a metaphysical gap there between the is and the ought in some way.
So in that case, so let's suppose for a minute there is a God. And my challenge that I think I tweeted to Justin is, you know, we've got this book, it's thousands of years old. You know, isn't God just being the worst marketeer ever at the moment? Because he's engaging Krish and his brain power and his knowledge and his study, you know, and then a list of other people all around the world tried to convince us that this really difficult document makes sense in all those ways. Why doesn't he just give us an update?
Why don't we get Bible 2.0?
Yeah, exactly.
With all the difficult bits.
With it all explained, taken out.
Well, it's called Paradoxology. You should buy it.
There you go. No, it isn't. I guess, again, you know, the Bible is the story that makes sense of God's universe, but the church should be, and you know, this is my job, and you get to it in the Corinthian paradox, that the church ought to be the place in which people are experiencing what God is doing today. And there's a problem because the church is full of really damaged, broken people that are making all sorts of mess ups. And sometimes we are rubbish at equality and justice and kindness, but sometimes we get it right. And because, you know, this church is a little bit like a time warp. So when you come in, you shouldn't be going back in time to the 18th century. You should be going forward in time to know what God is going to do with the universe. So the church is supposed to be the place, Tony, and you kind of mentioned it, this kind of community you've seen in the URC, that's a little taste of the way that God wants the world to be. That's you experiencing a little taste of, you know, the end of it all, actually, where we're all equal and in right relationship. So the church is the Bible 2.0, as it were.
I mean, can I just bring in as well a personal aspect to this, Krish? Because something you've been championing really hard the last 2 years is what you mentioned, fostering and adoption. This is something very personal to you. You have fostered and you've adopted as well. For you, how does this kind of play into this whole issue? Because there you've got a very real example of suffering in the world. There are kids who, because of broken relationships, a broken world, just don't have the chances that many other children do. Mm. Now, is it, you know, I read a tweet by Ricky Gervais the other day, and he's a well-known atheist, of course, and he said, you do good things because you're worried about getting punished in hell if you don't, then you're not actually doing anything good. I mean, what's your motivation for doing good? And is Ricky Gervais right about people's kind of, you know, basically they're worried about God and a stick?
Okay, well, Ricky Gervais is wrong in the sense that if a Christian is doing a good deed to try and get right with God, they're nuts. That's never going to work. You know, it's a bit like...
I did actually tweet him back. I don't think he saw it. I said, well, if that's what you think Christianity is, you've radically misunderstood.
So, you know, the idea is, you know, if Christians, one of the entry requirements of being a Christian is recognizing that you've stuffed up your life. You haven't lived as you ought to have done. And it's a bit like, you know, you're making an omelette and you crack an egg in it and you realize it's a completely disgusting, you know, gone off egg. No matter how many good eggs you put into that omelette, it's never going to get rid of the bad egg. You know, that it doesn't work like that. There's not a kind of scales that God's got for good versus bad. Everyone's stuffed up. And so what needs to happen is we need to receive forgiveness from God, hence the, you know, the cross paradox we get to in the book. But once you've received that from God, flipping heck, I can't believe that God was so generous to me that he adopted me, actually. That's the Bible story, that I was a vulnerable child. I'd messed up. This time it was my fault. Most vulnerable children has nothing to do with their history. But it was my fault I got myself in the mess I did. And God reached out to me, rescued me and adopted me. Having received that, I now want to help people. I want to pass that on. You know, I've received such amazing kindness from God. I want to show kindness to other people. That's what motivates the Christian. And for me, often, and we, you know, apologetics or kind of defending the faith is a verbal argument. I'm going to give you 14, you know, presuppositions and 4 points here, and I'll attack your worldview. And that's important, of course. But in the end, the proof is in the pudding. If the Christians are not living out this stuff, no one will ever believe what we say. And Jesus said it, you know, he said, let your light shine before men, let your good deeds shine before men, that they might see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. So the apologetic that this is true is that Christians should live the kind of lives that demonstrate it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's an interesting connection in terms of adoption with yourself, your own backstory. Is that right, Tony?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I was fostered and then adopted as a mixed-race child in northeast Scotland in the 60s, which was, wow, you know, a brave thing for my parents to do. Mm. I was in a school where, you know, I was the one who was a little bit olive-skinned and wasn't married to my cousin. You know, it was that sort of very small village school. Yeah. So I agree with Krish that the church that churches and the Christians that demonstrate what they're trying to do through good works are doing good works anyway, so that's great. And it is a way of making themselves relevant. So I've got a friend in the LGBT community who's a street pastor, and she does great work, and we share some passions and don't share other passions. So I think the practical demonstration of it, is great, and I see Chris's passion for equality. That comes out very, very clearly, and it's just the other bits I don't believe.
Well, let's move on to another paradox. Excuse me. And if you're interested in getting in touch yourself about any of these paradoxes as you listen, as I say, do get in touch. I'd be interested to hear from you too. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you want to find out more about my guests, find links to the programs, the book, and indeed find the ways to get in touch. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Follow on Twitter @unbelievablejb or on Facebook, look up Unbelievable, and you should find us there. Okay, talk us through, as in a nutshell, the Judas paradox. He's a character from the New Testament who has had a lot of ink spilled in terms of that whole question of, if Jesus had to be crucified, Judas was an integral part of that. But is it fair then to suggest that maybe he then didn't receive salvation, or that could he have done something else? Did he have any free will in this? So you've used him as kind of the center point of that whole question of free will, predetermined future and everything else. Describe this paradox for us, Chris.
Well, Judas is either to be the most hated person in history, isn't it? That he single-handedly killed the Messiah. I mean, flipping heck, that's an ultimate supervillain, isn't he? Or he's the most pitiable person in all of history, that he had no choice. He was a kind of puppet on a string. And, he's the patsy, as it were, that kind of ends up being the tool to execute Jesus. And I think neither of those extremes are actually fair. The Bible does seem to teach, a little bit like wave particle duality, two seemingly contradictory things: that God is in control of everything, that he works out his purposes, that this isn't random accidents that are taking place, that he's in control. And yet it still teaches there is human responsibility. And that is a really difficult one to put together. But to be honest, we're not alone in that. I quote a little bit from Sam Harris, who I don't think he's been on the show, but he's probably been quoted on the show.
I've tried to get him on. Who knows? Maybe one day.
He says this: free will is an illusion. Our wills are simply not of our own making. Thoughts and intentions emerge from background causes of which we are unaware and over which we exert no conscious control. That was in his book, Free Will. Interestingly, Sam Harris, in the introduction to the book, asserts the right as author to that book. In other words, he's claiming some intentionality, that if claim that you wrote the book, you can't claim that. But he's just told me he hasn't written the book because he has no free will in writing it. So, we all live with that tension. It's how you're going to resolve it.
Yes, absolutely. And people who go as far as Sam Harris, who deny free will, from a neurophysical point of view, do seem to be stuck with just the same problem as those who claim God, predetermines everything in some sense. And I know he's been having a bit of an online debate with Daniel Dennett actually on that, but I mean, Christians have tried to come up with ways of putting these two things together, and we did a very academic discussion a few months ago. William Lane Craig and Paul Helm, one a Molinist, one a Calvinist, and sort of talking about their different approaches to this. Without retreading too much of that ground, and you'll probably be glad we don't, Chris and Tony as well, but what I mean, how do you try again and put these together, or do you just say, well, we got two different things here, I can't give you an explanation how they work together, but again, it's the evidence, we see both things happening, so we just have to kind of hold them together in this tension.
Yeah, and you've got to work out, well, what do you do with it? Okay, so you could either conclude, okay, I have no responsibility because God's in control, therefore I can do what I like, there's no moral background, no moral responsibility, just live as you want. But that contradicts all the teaching of the Bible about living well, caring for widows and orphans, not being greedy or judgmental. And God holding us to account in the end, that says, you had a choice about how you lived. Did you follow my son? Did you trust in him? So however I hold that tension together needs to be in the wider context of the scriptures. And the Bible seems to say you can trust God that he has an overall plan and purpose. That means there's hope. That means there's redemption in suffering and difficulty. But also you need to take on board that you have some responsibility too. And it does hold those two in tension, and I need to be able to do that too.
Do you think the future is predetermined yourself, Tony, as an atheist?
I don't. I haven't been brave enough to listen to the William Lane Craig, the Molinist versus Calvinist. I keep looking at it and then thinking, no, perhaps not. So I'll have to do it after this. I think it isn't predetermined, and I think you know the authorship thing. You know, the description of the collection of cells and blood, currently known as Sam Harris, you know, asserts the right to this book. So you know, if I look at the coincidences in my life and in your life, Krish, you know, you've got six children. I've been married twice. I got five children. I was lucky enough to be adopted as a baby. I'm now Scottish. You know, your own identity with your very interesting background. I just see so many random events and sliding doors that got us to where we are. I find it very hard to believe that all that would be predetermined, because it's quite complicated. So I don't believe in that. I found chapter 10 really difficult. Maybe I was just reading it late at night or something, but I found it really difficult because, you know, you do end up in the position where you feel treating it as a bit of, you know, as a story. You feel very sorry for Judas, who seems to have been put in an impossible position. And was it predetermined for him or wasn't it? And I still don't really understand that from the point of view of the story.
What's your take on that, Krish? Is there a way of resolving the Judas paradox?
It does seem that, yes, God had a plan that Jesus would be crucified, and yet Judas is held responsible, that he seems to be making decisions from his point of view. So, yeah, it is wave-particle duality. There are two sets of evidences. I would say they don't lead to necessarily a contradiction, because there is a way that God could so set up the universe that he makes room for our free will. And I can't visualise that. I can't give you a nice little picture for it.
I suspect, and as I say on that show, the Molinist view has, I think, been gaining, if you like, if you do just take a kind of purely philosophical approach to it, though it is kind of hard to get your head around, that there is a ways of parsing that out in a way that could hold both together. But
I think in terms of the story, what you say, Krish, about the other people who have to take some responsibility along the line, the Jewish people, the Romans, and the public, the general public involved at that stage. I mean, that from a sort of you know, when you don't believe in predetermination, that makes more sense to me as a story, that other people had something to do with it. I couldn't believe that it was all neatly organised by a deity.
I mean, do you feel like the totality of the life that you've lived up till now that brings you to this present place, talking to Tony on this radio show, Krish, is at some level you can confidently say it's in God's plan, it's somehow God has been in control of this, even though I've made 100,000 decisions myself, as far as I'm aware?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, Christians, we look back, and I can't imagine how it was possible I became a Christian. You know, I had everything against me to become one. You know, I mixed race family, a little bit like Tony, one of the brownest kids in my school. You know, it just wasn't normal for me to do that, and yet I can only think that it was God intervening in my life. So Christians are very often caught saying thank you God for kind of reaching out to me when I couldn't have done it myself. We also pray as if God has intervened in the lives of other people, that he works his plans out through our prayers and by intervening into our world, so we're not just left on our own.
But why is it that and not the Richard Dawkins thing, where it's random? It's purposeless. There isn't an overarching story that you're fitting into. Is it just because you've kind of got this sort of existent belief in that God story that leads you to a completely different conclusion to Tony here, who says, nah, it is just random sort of thing?
Well, I guess you take the totality again, you know, so Tony rightly has got a massive passion about equality. Fantastic. I think that only makes sense within a universe that has some kind of moral consequences, that God has a purpose for it, that equality was part of his intention for how humans were going to engage with one another. And when we do it and we help people, there's something that clicks off in us, and that's right, because we're kind of clicking into the story. We're part of what God was doing. Or, you know, you recognise beauty and you go, there's something transcendent about this. Or when, you know, when you look at or you listen to a piece of music, it lifts you out of yourself into another dimension that we believe, you know, is something connecting with more than just kind of bones and blood and body bits, you know. So those are all kind of little tangents that draw us into this story. But the big one for me is that I believe as a Christian that God wrote himself into the story. And so, you know, Jesus, by becoming a person, tells us what it's all about. He's helping us understand and navigate who we are and what we're for and why we've got these kind of passions for justice and kindness and mercy. And he's explaining it to us, I think, more fruitfully, helpfully than any other system. So
we're going to take another quick break, gents, and we'll come back in a moment's time. Really interesting discussion today. My two guests, Krish Kandiah and Tony Smollett, looking at Krish's book, Paradoxology. If you want to go out and get yourself a copy or find it online, links with today's podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And be interested in hearing your thoughts as well. And towards the end of today's show, we'll also be hearing some of your feedback on previous programmes too. But come back in a moment's time here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Justin Brierley, and I'll be back for the third and final part of Unbelievable.
Do the Bible and science really contradict each other? Is there really a historical Adam and Eve? These are only a few of the questions that seem to indicate an apparent conflict between science and faith, and this is why Reasons to Believe exists. RTB's mission is to demonstrate that sound reason and scientific research consistently support, rather than erode, confidence in the truth of the Bible. Our work shows how the record of nature and the record of Scripture reveal the God of the Bible as Creator, Lord, and Savior. Find out how you also can give a skeptical world reasons to believe. Visit us today at reasons.org.
Welcome back to the third and final part of Unbelievable today, as we continue to look at Paradoxology by Krish Kandiah. We're going to be finishing up that conversation with Tony Smollett in just a moment's time. Still to come, some of your feedback to last week's programmes, including, as I mentioned, both atheists and Christians who have been getting in touch over things like the definition of faith from that very popular show between Tim McGrew and Peter Boghossian. Some responses still as well to the issues around Catholicism that were being debated between Peter D. Williams and Hans Kung. And of course, last week's show, Jeff Zwierink of Reasons to Believe joined me to discuss science and scripture with atheist geneticist Steve Jones. So listen out for some of the feedback on that. Next week here on the programme, I'm excited to be joined again by one of the guests from the forthcoming Unbelievable Conference. Clay Jones from Biola University will be joining me to discuss what is a perennial question, comes round time and again, the problem of suffering and evil. It's one of the seminars he's going to be leading at the conference in a few weeks' time. And he's going to be discussing that with atheist philosopher Richard Norman. He's been on the show a couple of times before as well, discussing issues with Peter Kraft and David Bentley Hart. Well, next week he's going to be in conversation with Clay Jones, who's a former talk show host himself, actually. So he's an interesting character, and you'll meet him next week on the show. Later on here on Premier Christian Radio, don't forget that the profile follows today's show. The guest today is Lord Paul Boateng, who's a former Labour MP for Brent South, but now sits in the House of Lords. And you'll be hearing about his life of faith as a Christian and a politician. And he was actually delivering the Premier lecture in the last week or so. And you'll be able to hear that lecture tomorrow evening here on Premier at 9 o'clock. So I do encourage you, if you're a Premier listener, to engage with that tomorrow at 9 in the evening. Okay, all of that to come later on, though. Right now, we're going to get into the last part of today's discussion between my guests, Krish Kandiah and Tony Smollett.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Tony, just in that last section then, Krish kind of giving a kind of, I suppose, a cumulative case, you might say, for why he just sees these fingerprints of God in our experience. You know, that we do have these yearnings for justice, which seem to somehow exist beyond just, you know, the physical reality of our life. He sees himself as part of more than just a random, you know, collection of atoms moving through the world. He sees that he's part of some kind of a bigger story and so on. Now, I guess as an atheist, even as a non-believer, you can see the attraction of that, because. But how do you kind of square that in your life in terms of, do you believe you can have purpose even if you actually ultimately think it's everything that's happened to you is basically, in the end of the day, random?
Yeah, I do. I believe I can have purpose and I can do things that make my world and the world at large better. You know, for quite basic things, you know, paying the proper amount of tax, the sort of things that have been in the news recently, just doing things that make our society fairer and trying to make sure I do those things. I mean, it's been interesting, and is it a random set of events that Chris and I end up on this radio show? There's a lot of strands that run through both our lives.
Which are very similar. And I have to say, when I got in touch with you, and this was a fairly random thing, so to speak, on Twitter, I had no idea that your individual stories had so many points of commonality. And it was very nice to discover that.
Mm.
But do you believe that is random, then?
Yes, I do. And what I find odd at the end of it, I meet Chris on the radio. If I met him face to face, I'd like him. I know I've seen all the videos. You know, it's very easy to get a taste of someone now. You know, a lovely video with Chris with your nephew when he's interviewing you. That's very, very funny. So I know I'd like you. I know you're a good person. My views haven't changed. They probably won't change. And in the end, you believe that I'll be damned in hell, which is quite, you know, that's a sort of slightly discordant thought at the end of it all.
Well, I think we've got to answer that, Chris. What do you say in response to that?
Well, it's more that, look, I was drowning once and someone reached out to rescue me. If they hadn't reached out to rescue me, I would be dead. The Bible says everybody's drowning. We're all in need, you know. And God wants to reach out to us to give us a new life, a new start. And if we reject that, it's a bit like someone throwing you a life belt. If we reject that, that isn't God saying, you know, you weren't good enough, you're somehow different or not worthy. It's us saying no to God. So part of my life is to help people say, look, I can't believe that God rescued me. I didn't deserve it. I messed up, broke every law that you could imagine in God's kind of litany of things against me that I'd done. And yet God still acted in mercy. I just want other people to know it, you know. So it's not a judgment thing on you, Tony. It's saying, come and receive what we've got. It was given to us free. We'd love you to have it too.
I still end up at that same conclusion, which is fine because I don't believe it'll happen. I'll close my eyes and nothing will happen.
I mean, is the issue for you, going back to this thing you started out with, Tony, that if that is the case, you don't feel like God's done a good enough job in getting you to a place where you could believe that, if so much rests on it, if you like?
I can't critique something I don't believe exists. That would be odd. You know, I mean, Chris mentions, you know, people who, some atheists who try to both criticize God for the things he's done, you know, some of the Old Testament things and so on, and even some of the paradoxes, people where they don't believe the explanation. Well, you can't criticize God if you don't believe he exists. That seems a peculiar thing to do.
One of our guests sometimes says, I'm mad at God. I don't believe in God, and I'm really angry with him.
That just doesn't make sense to me.
Anyway, it's been really interesting having your perspective on the show today, Tony. And thank you for being game to come on at fairly short notice on my part and take part in this discussion. And for being so willing to engage. I think it's been a really interesting discussion.
Yeah, well, I've enjoyed getting to know you, Tony. Thanks for the time. Hope we'll stay in touch on Twitter at least.
Yeah, no, that'd be great. Thanks, Christian. Thanks, Justin. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoy the show, and I did enjoy it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for coming on again. Thank you, Chris, for coming in. people can obviously get hold of the book via your website. Do you want to give that as well, so that people who want to follow the blog
and so
on? Yeah,
if you want to find out, there's some extra material, videos and stuff available, chrishk.com. You should be able to find me. Otherwise, just Google Krish Kandiah.
Yes, everything is available via the munders of Google. Other search engines are available. thanks for coming in, Krish. Paradoxology, if you want to get hold of it, available now, and I'll post links with today's programme, as I mentioned, at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Hope to have you on again at some point, because this has been really fun, and it'd be great to get you back in.
Great. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. And we're going to hear some of your responses as well in a moment's time to previous editions of the programme. You're listening to Unbelievable here on Premier Radio.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thanks all those who have been getting in touch via email. Here's Michael, who says, I listened to last week's programme. After you'd spent 15 minutes introducing your Christian pal, you spent a third of that time introducing the atheist. Including the break, the conversation actually lasted 35 minutes, if that. I did at one time tune into your programme on a regular basis. Nowadays, I dip in only on occasion to look at your podcast to see if there might be an interesting dialogue to set the cells in motion. The main reason for this being your obvious Christian bias. Not good, really. This week's atheist guest was intellectually up to the task, but nowhere near forceful enough. When are you going to ever get an intellectually strong and feisty atheist guest on? Anyway, you go on to give some of the reasons why you disagreed with Jeff Zwiering on last week's programme. And finally end up, I would have attended your reasonable faith conference, but I don't think my stomach could take it. I'd certainly take some rotten tomatoes along. It seems to me that you're putting on a meeting for the already converted to arm themselves with one-liners in order to prove Jesus is believable when faced with counter-arguments. Straight away, the dialogue ends before it begins. Well, look, Michael, I appreciate that you've taken the time to listen to the programme. I get, you know, interactions from many atheists who don't take the same line as you. They feel we do a fairly good job here of trying to represent both sides. I'm sorry you felt it was a bit one-sided last week. There are some technical reasons, actually, why I wasn't able to give as much airtime as I would have liked to, actually, to Steve Jones. I won't bore you with the details, but normally, yes, I take your point. There's normally a bit more of an equal airtime for both. But despite that, the conference, well, I'm sorry we won't see you there. I'm not sorry we won't see your rotten tomatoes, but it's not quite the same. It's not a dialogue, the conference. I'll be upfront about that. It is much more, as it were, giving people reasons to believe, you know, a Christian worldview. There is, of course, Q&A, and anyone is able and happy to attend, a Christian, atheist, or anywhere else they may find themselves. But it is, of course, being presented by Christian speakers and thinkers. So that's what you sign up for if you come to the conference. But certainly not just arming them with one-liners in order to prove Jesus is believable. I think it goes a lot deeper than that. You know, it's about really getting to grips with these fundamental questions, not just giving pat answers. And I hope you don't find that we do that on the show here. Anyway, I wanted to bring that one up because I do like to, you know, air the criticism as well as the praise. So thanks for getting in touch, Michael. Let's talk about Unbelievable, the conference, briefly. And if you've already heard this 1,000 times and you're listening on podcast, you can skip ahead if you want. But I would like to let you know that it's just around the corner, 4 weeks away, Saturday the 12th of July. We're really looking forward to this year's conference. There's so much that's going to be on offer. Probably our biggest and best conference ever. You'll have the opportunity to hear from and interact with some of the world's leading thinkers on science, faith, philosophy and evangelism. Keynote speaker Oz Guinness and William Lane Craig, of course. Oz Guinness actually will be joining me on a programme in the not too distant future. So we're looking forward to that as well. And as I've mentioned, loads of resources, seminars and everything else coming up. Well, rather than tell you about that again, why don't you listen to this? There's a video that's available on the website if you go there, promoting the conference and giving an idea of the place where we're going to be meeting, Westminster Central Hall, a beautiful venue in central London. Well, if this audio from that video promo tempts you in any way, why not go online and watch it? But here's me walking around and being rather dramatic in Westminster Central Hall.
we are growing to be more and more moral as we become less and less religious.
The New Testament is chock full of discrepancies and contradictions.
God, when I discovered that Father Christmas was a fabrication, and I thought, what else have they been lying to me about?
Aspects of the current world.
So, if there is a God, why does he allow evil?
How do you know that Jesus rose from the dead?
I believe we can see the evidence for the existence of God.
Welcome to Westminster Central Hall, the beautiful venue for this year's Unbelievable the Conference 2014, Reasonable Faith in an Uncertain World, presented by Premier Radio and Biola University in association with Reasons to Believe. I'm Justin Brierley. I'll be hosting this year's conference, which is now in its fourth year, and it is the leading conference for evangelism and apologetics here in the UK. Here in this hall, we'll be hearing from some of the world's leading Christian thinkers about the evidence for Christian faith. It'll help you to be bold in your faith and share it effectively. You'll learn how to engage fruitfully with Islam, atheism, and other worldviews. And you'll learn about the reasons for God and the truth of Christianity.
The best explanation of the evidence is that Jesus rose from the dead and was who he claimed to be.
How does the atheist even tell us what evil is?
Fear no questions.
And do go to the website to find out more about the speakers, more details about the day and all the topics we'll be covering. That's premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. And you can find out about the special offer of a DVD for every two or more tickets booked. I hope you can join me here in Westminster Central Hall on Saturday, the 12th of July, for what promises to be a really engaging, fruitful, and thought-provoking day. Do come along.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to that. It's even better to watch it, though. It is obviously a video from which I've taken the audio. And if you want to, then go to the website of the event to avail yourself of the video and to see the place and some of the things that we're going to be discussing and the people we're going to be hearing from on Saturday, the 12th of July. premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. And I do look forward to seeing you there. OK, let's look at last week's programme. And we had a bit of response in to Jeff Swearink and atheist geneticist Steve Jones talking about science and Christianity. Evan in California says Jeff and Reasons to Believe celebrate the striking harmony of science and Christianity. To show how compatible the two are, they love to cite very vague notions such as fine-tuning and the universe having a beginning, which is more of an argument for theism than for Christianity. Let's remember Reasons to Believe believe in a literal Genesis 2 and 3, Adam and Eve placed in a magical garden with a talking snake. RTB and initially placed the fall between 10 to 25,000 years ago. They had to move it back to 45,000 years due to compelling archaeological evidence. Now, thanks to genetics, they're forced to place the Garden of Eden around 150,000 years ago. Do scientists really believe cavemen had agriculture, cities and Jewish names over 100,000 years ago? Reasons to Believe seem to freely cherry-pick both scripture and science. Well, we didn't really get into those issues, obviously, on last week's programme, though I know that people like Hugh Ross and others are more than willing to debate and defend their position as an organisation and how they put the passages in Genesis 2 and 3 together with the findings of modern science and so on. So perhaps we could do that another time, Evan. Perhaps you'd be willing to come on yourself and have that kind of a debate. Thanks for getting in touch anyway. Sharla is out in the States as well.
And she's part of the Assemblies of God National Leadership and Resource Centre. Says she's one of the listeners who discovered this programme through the Phil Vischer podcast. Appreciate the dialogue and discussion on the show, even when it makes me uncomfortable. Your ability to show kindness and respect is a large part of why I keep listening every week. As our culture seems to continually become more ugly towards each other, the debates you organise are on the whole reassuring. And you wanted to tell me about a conference that you've been organising too. Well, Dr. Jim Bradford, the General Secretary of Assemblies of God, has been behind it. And it's their Faith and Science Conference going on, I think, in Springfield, Missouri. So if anyone's interested in that, go check it out. In fact, people like John Lennox, Hugh Ross, Fuzz Rana and Jeff Zwiering are actually contributing to that. And you say, the more I listen to your podcast, the smaller the world seems to get. Thank you very much indeed, Sharla. Here's Thomas, who says, I continue to be as inspired as ever by Unbelievable, a great light in the Christian world for anyone who wishes to think about and examine their faith. I work for the opera company Glyndebourne right now. I'm actually an opera singer and am commuting every day, so I make sure I have a long back catalogue of Unbelievable shows to listen to that I've missed in the part. My profession is a tough one for Christians in many ways, much like being in the acting world. While I believe from the bottom of my heart that one sees God's fingerprints over the great music of history, for example, Mozart would simply write out sublime music without needing to correct anything, as though he was being dictated to almost, and Beethoven composed some of his greatest works when completely deaf. It can be quite a fickle and amoral atmosphere in the profession, making it hard to always keep one's eyes focused on Jesus Christ. Your show is part of the way in which I do this, and I can't thank you enough for having such a profound influence on my faith, and thus my life itself. I will be buying 3 tickets to the conference this year, and bringing an old friend of yours. Thank you. And I know the friend in question. It'll be lovely to see her again. You wanted to talk about the Kong Williams debate. You said, despite his declarations to the contrary, Kong seems to pretty much be a professing Protestant in terms of his point of view. I imagine he simply loves his church and the tradition he grew up in too much to abandon it, which I strongly sympathise with. However, it seems that Peter Williams rather thought of him as a heretic. This latter guest is such a clever speaker and somehow always manages to overcome his antagonist on your show by quick wit and some cleverly thought out arguments. However, it always seems to me as a Protestant that they don't really hold water upon closer examination. If I may be so bold, someone of Peter D. Williams' rhetorical skill needs a sufficiently fiery interlocutor who can really challenge his theology. You also wanted to say you were very impressed by the show with featuring Tim McGrew, who seemed so calm and methodical in disproving everything Peter Boghossian had to say. He seemed to exemplify what your show is about, dealing logically and rationally with the arguments atheists have and ultimately showing them to be unfair and even illogical at times. All right, thank you very much for your feedback on that as well. Let's get this. Definitions of faith came up a lot, didn't they, in that discussion between Peter Boghossian and Tim McGrew. This one in from, I think it's Joseph in the US, says, writing in response to that show, I'm flabbergasted by one of your guest's positions, Tim McGrew's statement that less than 1% of Christians use the word faith to mean trusting in something even when there's no empirical evidence. Unless I am in a completely different universe from you and your listeners, I can't see how a person couldn't agree that the vast majority of people in the world use the word faith to mean something along the lines of what Boghossian was saying. Tim McGrew cited Oxford English Dictionary's first definition of faith, complete trust or confidence in someone or something, which I think is a good description of the colloquial usage. Yet he didn't mention the second given definition, strong belief in God or in the doctrines of a religion based on spiritual apprehension rather than proof. That second definition seems to perfectly capture the way almost everyone I have ever known has used the word faith in a religious sense. And that was also the opinion of Phil, who emailed in to say, I thought you might be interested to hear some reflections on Tim McGrew. I think we should take Tim McGrew up on his use of the Oxford English Dictionary definition of faith, and you go on to make the same point that the second definition in the Oxford English Dictionary is about a strong belief in the doctrines of religion based on conviction rather than proof. And you go on to say, in my experience, people that jump out of planes, and I've done so more than 1,000 times, do not have complete trust in their parachute. That's why we jump with a reserve parachute. We know that parachutes can fail and we train for that eventuality. We know there is a risk of death and assess the risk versus reward trade-off, just as people do when they ride horses or drive cars. Complete confidence is not a factor. Do Christians have the same view of Jesus? Do they know he might fail them, so they use a backup? Would Tim McGrew like to come and jump out of a plane, putting his faith in Jesus to save him rather than a parachute? Okay, well, I understand what you're saying, and obviously all analogies break down if you do that kind of thing and say there's a reserve parachute and so on. But I don't know. I think that in a sense, whether it's skydiving or something else, Tim's point stands that we often put our trust in things without having absolute 100% evidence, but we have good enough evidence, if you like, to trust in them. Okay, just time for one final one from Stephen on this, who's writing from Manchester, Connecticut in the US, and you want to support Tim McGrew's definition of faith as trusting, holding to, and acting on what one has good reason to believe is true in the face of difficulties. You've talked about the Catholic Church's catechism and also the larger catechism of the Westminster Standards. Both definitions emphasize that faith is grounded by evidence. This evidence does include the self-revelation of God, but even Richard Dawkins seems to think that this would be required or at least helpful. You raise one of his writings there in the God Delusion. You've also taken a bit from C.S. Lewis's book Mere Christianity, where he explains two senses in which Christians use the word faith. You say the first sense is where it means belief, accepting or regarding as true the doctrines of Christianity. And to explain what this really means, he uses an illustration about overcoming a fear that anesthesia might not work in surgery. And you quote here, "It is not reason that is taking away my faith. On the contrary, my faith is based on reason. It is my imagination and emotions. The battle is between faith and reason on the one side and imagination on the other. The second and higher sense of faith involves a type of active response." And in this context, Lewis says, "Now, once again, what God cares about is not exactly our actions. What he cares about is that we should be creatures related to him in a certain way." Okay, thank you very much for that, Stephen. Helpful to have a few more definitions of faith from those sources. But sorry, I haven't had time to address any more of the many letters and emails and comments that came in regard to that programme. It was a popular one. Thanks for being in touch. Thanks for listening today, and do hope you can come back at the same time next week. Let me tell you what's coming up then. You're unbelievable. Probably one of the most perennial objections to Christianity is, why does God allow so much suffering and evil in the world? Well, Clay Jones from Biola University is going to be helping us to think through that at Unbelievable, the Conference 2014. And next week on the show, he joins me to discuss that very question with atheist Richard Norman. So come back for that at the same time next week. Until then, have a great week. And if you're continuing to listen here on Premier Christian Radio, do check out The Profile coming up next with Lord Paul Boateng. Until then, see you next time.